The connection between digital ID and stablecoins is the end game for humanity. And I think we're kind of there.
I don't measure in dollar terms. Like, I measure in self-sovereignty terms. I have more Bitcoin today than I did yesterday. So yeah, now I can still transact freely and without censorship and permissionlessly.
Bitcoin is moral money, right? It's ethical money. That's very important to me, right? I think the only way to express that is through self-custody.
Stablecoins are a CBDC that have yet to be activated. They're highly centralized. Tether already openly and admittedly censors transactions in compliance with law enforcement. That's a horrible gateway into a lot of really bad things.
I'm not even sure I want, you know, the United States government to buy Bitcoin or continue to confiscate or hold confiscated Bitcoin, even I think unjustly in some cases. But I would love to see them just treat it as nice as they treat the dollar.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Cedric Jungelman of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Cedric is an awesome guy, super based. We cover everything. If you are interested in thoughts on stablecoins, treasury companies, we talk politics, we talk about a wild conspiracy Cedric has around Ross Ulbricht, ETFs, literally everything is in this episode. I think you're going to love it. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Cedric here. Cedric, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. So I told you offline, man, I'm looking forward to this. I've had a lot of topical episodes the last few I've recorded, and we're just going to kind of hit all the big themes, news, everything around Bitcoin. And I've been a fan of your podcast for a while. I think you've got some great takes. So I want to just start with your take on the state of Bitcoin, right? We've seen some price action. We're sitting at 91,800 at the time of recording. And I think a lot of people are bearish and some people are, you know, you should be bullish. And why is the price dipping? You can weigh in on any of that. But what's your thought that you would share with all the Bitcoiners out there?
Oh, man, I think that it's like one of the most depressing times in Bitcoin from so many angles. And I think that's probably like a really great, probably really bullish for because I think of myself as a contra signal. But like, I'm frustrated with just the whole conversation. It seems like this year, it seems like it's just a lot of suit talk and stable coins and crypto. And a lot of the ethos is just sort of like the air has just been let out of the balloon. Less people seem interested in sort of separating money from state. Maybe that's just a factor. I think it's, you know, the positive spin on it. I was talking to Walker America yesterday and he said, maybe that's just how early we are. And that's what I think makes me optimistic about it. Like, all that fervor can come back for those kinds of things. But I think it's a reflection of how much bigger the scene is and how much more accepted Bitcoin is in just sort of regular finance. Yeah. To me, it feels way less zeitgeisty, Bitcoin. It's part of my conversation with Walker yesterday just to kind of dwell on that. But I feel like, you know, Bitcoin is sort of the antithesis of the zeitgeist right now. So I felt like up until a year ago, if Bitcoin was in, say, the name of your podcast, it would be like, wow, like that might be interesting no matter what that is. And I think it's almost like, oh, I've probably heard that already.
Yeah.
And maybe that's still a signal of how early we are. But I think it's been so. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's the most exciting time in Bitcoin at the surface level. That doesn't mean that people aren't working on things that we don't know about or, you know, even things that maybe you've heard of, but just they've been quietly kind of just, you know, getting to work. And usually during I don't think this is a true bear market, but this hasn't been a robust bull market, especially in terms of maybe measuring in monetary supply or in gold terms. But there's just no excitement. And you would think that during a bear market, when things get tough, is when people, I guess, build. That's great about a bear market. But you would think that there'd be sort of, the ranks would pull in and we'd be focusing on what matters, especially before it blows up again, hopefully in a positive way and gets a lot bigger.
Yeah. We've been spending a lot of this time fighting, too, it seems like.
Which, yeah.
As I understand it, that's sort of Bitcoin for you. I've only been around coming up on 4 years, so my first cycle is almost through. But the sentiment, the funny thing is, like, for me, the way I look at it is I saw someone last night and he asked what I did. I told him I worked in Bitcoin and he's like, oh man, it's been down, hasn't it? I was like, I mean, I don't measure my wealth. I don't measure in dollar terms. Like I measure in self-sovereignty terms, and I have more Bitcoin today than I did yesterday. And so, yeah, no, I can still transact freely and without censorship and permissionlessly. So I'm doing great, but I agree with you. I think there's kind of this focus on the number that drags the emotions down with us, perhaps. But I'm still very hopeful for the future, which I assume you are as well.
Yeah, no, I'm really optimistic, but I just don't think it's just for me hasn't been the most exciting year conversation wise or narrative wise. And, you know, when I do kind of go into places where I think people are talking about what they're working on, it's a lot more about bringing tokenized assets to layer two and about stable coins. And I think those things we could discuss, you know, what place they have in sort of the economic landscape, but that's not truly exciting to me. I would want to hear more conversation about self-custody and privacy and security, and try to keep that sort of core ethos of not just number go up. While that might be the most exciting and important thing about Bitcoin in a lot of ways. But I would love to hear more about separating money from state and sort of the ethos of self-custody. And what's interesting is, I mean, it's hard to feel like you're part of a revolution when Larry Fink is at the forefront of the discussion,
yeah.
You know, and I'd like to see it as sort of, you know, Larry Fink bending his knee to Bitcoin, but I still think that Wall Street thinks that we're going to be bending the knee to them.
I completely agree.
And so that's where I'm like, wow, let's not just fall asleep here at the wheel. I think of Bitcoin a lot like the way I think of the internet. And I think a lot of people think, you know, it's like the internet has a 0 to 100 sort of potential of what it can be. And it, you know, it might not reach its full potential in terms of sort of disseminating, decentralizing information throughout society. I mean, it's only at 70% adoption. It's not even fully adopted yet. So much of it is centralized. So, you know, I'm hopeful for, you know, the future of Bitcoin, but I don't know if we'll obtain its, you know, achieve its full potential.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting few years, because as I think about, like, have you read Larry Lippard's book, The Big Print? Like, it's one of my favorite newer books. And I wonder, and then when I think about like Parker Lewis's, you know, Gradually Then Suddenly, I'm like, man, if like, we really are like potentially one big event from this gradually turning into this suddenly, like these books all work together if you sort of read them appropriately, I think. And I don't know if that's a year from now. I don't know if it's tomorrow. I don't know if it's 10 years from now, or if we're going to be, you know, sitting at 10% adoption 20 years from now. But it could be a very interesting ride, I think.
Sure. But I think about sort of the vector we're on. And I think if, you know, 33 to 66% of the coins end up in ETFs and other centralized vehicles, I worry about Bitcoin more being sort of treated in society as a digital pet rock.
Yeah.
The way gold is sort of looked at as, you know, a commodity, an asset, a hedge, a tool, but not sort of a way of life, or, you know, the economy is not built around gold.
I spoke about that at BTC Prague, actually. I think Bitcoin only wins if it's used as money in all of its for all of its attributes that it should be used. And I think medium of exchange is important. So let's talk about that first then. Square recently started allowing its 4 million merchants to accept Bitcoin. I think that's going to be probably a slow trickle. I don't think there's a sense of urgency amongst many merchants, but perhaps you've got people who are early in their Bitcoin journey who say, hey, I've got a store, I've got, you know, I own a small business, you know, if even just a couple customers pay, cool, I get to stack some sats. What do you think is the significance of that? Is that something you're like, you know, real excited about, or have you paid attention?
I'm super excited about it. I think the significance is huge. I think what I'm having a hard time measuring is how much this will be utilized because of the tax treatment, specifically in the US. I think that's still a major deterrent. There is a function, I think, with the Cash App where when you buy something, if the merchant says, like, I want to receive sats, you can convert your dollars into sats so that they receive Bitcoin. You don't spend Bitcoin and there's no taxable transaction. I believe that's built in.
I think so.
I don't know how much people are aware of that and stuff. And I don't know what that does for necessarily. I would hope that adds to the Bitcoin economy. I haven't, you know, done math on it. But it sounds like there's a buy there and no sell. You know, it's not just transfer. But point being, though, is if it was truly using your own sats and you had to think about, like, when did I buy these things? Am I up? Am I down on these particular sats? And as a merchant trying to think about how to use your money if you needed it and when did you buy it, I would think that's an accounting and tax nightmare. So I still think that's a major hurdle. And, you know, sort of I connect that to the SBR. I mean, I would love for America to treat Bitcoin just as money, more than even just buy it. And in fact, I'm not even sure I want, you know, the United States government to buy Bitcoin or continue to confiscate or hold confiscated Bitcoin, even, I think, unjustly in some cases. But I would love to see them just treat it as nice as they treat the dollar and treat it as money. And so that they're not even a de minimis, oh, $600 of capital gains is ignored. Like the whole thing, just you can use it as money. That would be wild. Yeah. And so I don't know how much there will be adoption of what Cash App is doing. Now, even from a merchant standpoint, though, you can save tremendous amount of fees. I mean, I think Cash App is waiving the fees for the first year. And then I think the fees will still probably be lower than credit card. And then I think you could then eliminate chargebacks. So, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer for merchants. But yeah, they still need consumers to have sats on them or know that they can, you know, use dollars and convert.
Yeah. So we'll yeah. See. I think it's a big deal. I agree with you. Unfortunately, I'm not holding my breath for politicians to welcome a competitor into the ring when it comes to medium of exchange. I mean, for me, I won't get too specific, but I think the point of sale moments are could be acts of civil disobedience, perhaps, where really? Maybe you don't concern yourself too much with the accounting implications of what you're doing. But I think ultimately, regardless, that's what we need. I think that's what we need for people to stop worrying about what the suits are doing with Bitcoin anyway. It's I spend time thinking about what Larry Fink or Michael Saylor or anyone else are doing with Bitcoin to the extent that it's a pertinent news story for us to talk about. Beyond that, it has zero impact on my life, on my conviction, on what I believe the future of Bitcoin to be. And I think it's become a distraction, in my opinion. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I do agree. But at the same time, I love what they are doing with Bitcoin. And it makes sense, I think. I like it.
It was inevitable, that's for sure.
It's inevitable. And there's going to be experimentation. I think Bitcoin's going to eat Wall Street. But along the way, Wall Street's going to try to make as much money as they can. And I think Bitcoin's going to be very profitable for them in terms of the plumbing and the on-ramps and the off-ramps and all the fees they can make. I mean, IBIT is already the most profitable EFT ever. It's the fastest growing EFT ever. Vanguard just got into the game. Schwab is getting into the game. There's tons of fees to be made in perpetuity. I mean, you have a $1 billion fund and you're making 20, 40, 60, 80, $100 million a year. And as that fund grows, those fees just grow. I mean, this is phenomenal money when they're having a hard time making a lot of fees in other areas and growing their other, you know, sort of their profit lines. So, and then I think, you know, like think about like your 84-year-old grandma, or in my case, my mother. Like my mom happens to be a Bitcoiner, right? But like self-custody is sort of tricky for people in their 80s. In that case, you know, maybe EFTs make sense for people who just want price exposure. I mean, but for real Bitcoiners, I don't think that gives them any of the qualities of Bitcoin. Right. Even a small amount, I mean, $1 worth of Bitcoin or $10 worth of Bitcoin or whatever you can afford, wherever you start. Once you take self-custody of that, and for most people, they don't even take the first amount of Bitcoin they buy in self-custody. Usually, you buy a little, you leave it on the exchange, and you buy a little bit more, and then you get enough where you're like, wow, maybe I should start thinking about my counterparty risk, right? But I think there's going to be an evolution where, you know, you have your first X amount of dollars on dollar value of Bitcoin on an exchange, and you're like, wow, this thing is 10X or 100X since I've been stacking sats, and I have 50,000 there. Maybe I should take 5,000 out and think about learning how to self-custody that, right? And then you go through this thing where you're like, maybe I should take 45,000 out and leave 5,000 there. And I'm really good at this, right? And then that thing grows another 10x and you're like, okay, this is not just like my little get rich thing over here, but this, my family's counting on this now, not just for me, but what if I pass on? So now I'm the counterparty risk to myself, right? So now I got to eliminate all single, maybe I want to move away from a single hardware wallet. Maybe I want to learn about multi-sig and take half of this stack and put it in multi-sig now, learn about that. Some people think single sig is better than multi-sig. You got to learn for yourself. You got to think about your own personal threat vector. You know, do you have geographical risk, jurisdictional risk? You know, how do you manage your inheritance? Right. And so then maybe you have a big enough stack where you're like, wow, like this thing is worth $10 million now. I'm going to put $2 million in an ETF and I'm going to put $6 million. I'm making these numbers up. I mean, if people are like, lucky enough to have all this. And it's like, just thinking percentages, right? I'm going to take 10% or 20%, put that in the EFT so that like maybe the people in my life who are so scared about Bitcoin and keys, they feel comfortable. And then I'll have 60% in my, you know, my multi-sig and 20% in my single sig and 3% in my hot wallet, right? And then, you know, you could look at sort of like Michael Saylor, where I think of like Bitcoin is where, you know, if your first 5 or 10% of your, let's say your income, if you put that into Bitcoin, that's sort of like saving into Bitcoin. You're using Bitcoin. And I think it's the best savings technology in the world. And I learned this from Pierre Richard, but it's like from 11 to like 50%, maybe you're investing in Bitcoin now. You're like, wow, I think this thing's not just like way to save money and avoid debasement, but like maybe I'll get ahead, you know? And then maybe, you know, if you're 51% to 99% or 100% into Bitcoin, that's like sort of speculating Bitcoin. Like you're maybe like, hey, maybe I'll be able to retire in 2 years, you know? And it's, and then Michael Saylor will, you know, kind of go around that and put a wrapper and say, whatever you have in Bitcoin, like maybe you want to invest in something that's not Bitcoin. All of that's your savings. All of that's your risk off, right? Don't you have some room in your life for risk on? If you consider Bitcoin to be your risk-free or your risk off, like, are you not going to invest in your own entrepreneur ventures? Maybe you want to, or maybe you work at a job that you don't have a lot of entrepreneurial effect on, or, you know, it's not your business. So maybe you want to invest in securities where you're like, I think I'm early to this thing on its trajectory, you know, compared to Bitcoin in the short term, maybe, right? Maybe it won't be Bitcoin long term, right? And that's how people might look at Bitcoin treasury companies or things like that. But so like the fact that like there are Bitcoin ETFs is not something that upsets me. I think it's awesome. I just don't think it's awesome. Like when someone's like, oh, should I buy Bitcoin? I'm not like, oh, the ETF is awesome.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and when people are like Bitcoin treasury companies, I'm like, that's awesome for pension companies. Right. I think if you're buying the common shares of MicroStrategy, you're betting on it getting all that trapped capital, right? But on the other hand, you say, well, maybe they haven't gotten that much trapped capital and all the appreciation has come from retail, right? And I don't like the retail side or the retail love of these things. But, you know, some people in retail are like, they think of themselves as very savvy and they see a trend and they see an opportunity, or they think they have inside information, whether that's totally legal. Like, you know, I'm a Bitcoiner. I read in Bitcoin News that this company is going to buy Bitcoin. I can get in at a low MNAV or pipe deal. I think people are going to get excited about it. Is that like shitcoining? Yeah, it's exactly like shitcoining. I mean, but, you know, so it's like, and it's kind of like where you are on it. You know, like some of the people that are the biggest detractors in the world about Bitcoin, I always wonder if they actually have Bitcoin, like Christine Lagarde.
Yeah.
And then Walker told me yesterday that her son supposedly has Bitcoin. And Peter Schiff, his son, has Bitcoin. And if they were so, not, if first of all, I think like when you're so against something, you kind of understand it more than you're letting on. And then you might even like I remember when I was shitcoining before I became a Bitcoin maxi. you know, I didn't understand this thing right away. I didn't know anything about cryptography. I wasn't a coder. I didn't know a lot about monetary history or Austrian economics. I thought I found new technology. I thought I found the whole, all of it before other people. You know, it was all interesting to me. I thought blockchain was the secret sauce. But there was a journey that I went on, and I came out of that not just thinking I want to save or invest or speculate in Bitcoin, but that it was morally and ethically important to me that Bitcoin succeeded, not just for me or how it would affect me, but just for the world. And so there was a moment in time where I'm like, I don't want to hold these shit coins anymore. Like, and a friend of mine, he's really good with shit coining, really good at crypto and all that stuff. And kind of gets it. He's a coder and he understands tech and he understands the difference. And he thinks that probably Bitcoin is his, you know, what do they call it? Like when you save into Bitcoin, everyone, they take their profits in crypto and put it in Bitcoin. But, he was like, he told me about Chainlink. And there was this point in time where I'm like, I want to sell this thing. And when I sold it, because I didn't want to hold it anymore, I didn't want to go to sleep at night thinking I held this thing. Well, that thing went up a lot more than the Bitcoin I bought with the money I sold it with.
Mm-hmm.
Over a short period of time. I'm an accountant by trade. I still looked at the numbers. I said, wow, I would have probably done 10x better over this one year, two year, three year period from the moment I sold on. But I made a moral decision. And whether, you know, I said, whether it goes up or down, this is what I want to do because I don't want to own that. So, you know, I don't know if Christine Lagarde morally is opposed to Bitcoin or if she just really hates it because she knows it's a threat to her business model. But that doesn't prevent her from buying it for herself.
Yeah, yeah. You got to give her a big benefit of the doubt to imagine she's raising moral questions in her mind.
Supposedly her son buys it. And if her son buys it, whether she is directly giving him the money or through sort of her, you know, raising of him and that leading to sort of opportunities, there's sort of a wealth transfer there, right? And you would think if she was so morally opposed to Bitcoin, it was such a threat to humanity, she would be like, no, you cannot buy Bitcoin. No one in my family can buy Bitcoin. Like people who are like racist or bigots or like all these things who are like, you know, you can't marry, like they tell others not to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like the family doesn't do this thing. The family is anti-Bitcoin. Like Spencer, if you buy Bitcoin, you're out of the family. We're a gold family, you know? And so to me, I think that, I mean, Peter is, they said, Peter will tell you can send him Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I think he has more than just what people have sent him to.
I do. That's what I'm saying.
I completely agree. He's definitely a Bitcoiner because he's certainly gotten railed on in enough debates to understand it in a sufficiently fundamental way that if he likes gold, he's really going to like Bitcoin. I've been thinking more about this too, like the idea of saving versus investing versus speculating. And I would probably skew the numbers. I think I view Bitcoin today, like I refer to it always as savings. Like I don't tell people I invest in Bitcoin. However, it is both my savings vehicle and my investment vehicle because I look around and I don't see anything where I have an asymmetry of knowledge or time to outperform what I think Bitcoin's going to do over the next 20 years. I suspect, though, that it will come a point in my life where I'll say, hey, like now Bitcoin is just my savings vehicle because it doesn't have a 50% CAGR. You know, it doesn't even have a 30 or a 40% CAGR. There's a business I could start or there's some other opportunity that I could pursue that I think is going to outperform Bitcoin at some point down the road. And then Bitcoin continues to serve as my savings vehicle. And I look for ways to produce value in the world that justify greater returns where I do have some asymmetry in terms of, you know, knowledge, time, and so forth. And then speculation, I mean, in my view, that's like, it's like going to the casino, you know, like maybe, you know, and like, that's how I kind of feel about treasury companies personally. Like, I think if you want to, I think the average person putting money into treasury companies, it's speculation because we have no idea how it's really going to go. It's a very novel concept. I get sick and tired of them because it's a distraction from self-custody Bitcoin. It's a distraction from the revolution, the bright future, right? And I don't, I'm unconvinced at this point that it propels us into that bright orange future any faster, but it certainly keeps a lot of people from focusing on the fundamentals of Bitcoin and self-custody. But if you just say, hey, I'm going to take a small bit of money and just throw it into strategy, throw it into whatever, and just, you know, who knows, maybe it'll blow up and I'll have these crazy returns. Okay, go knock yourself out. You know, people play roulette and people play blackjack. But I think people need to be they need to understand that if you don't really understand what's going on, you're not investing, you're definitely not saving, you're probably just speculating. Once you can make those distinctions, then I think, you know, if do what you want to do and have fun. You'd mentioned a couple of times stable coins. I would love to hear. I'll share my opinion after you share yours. What do you think of stable coins? I know you said it's, you know, it's like, hey, like it's not the most exciting thing to talk about. Do you think are they significant for Bitcoin adoption? Are they a concern in terms of control by state? Like, where's your head on?
Oh, I think stable coins are actually extremely exciting to talk about because they're very scary. And I think they're also pretty practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so I they annoy me in the sense of if I go to like a Bitcoin conference and it's 100% stable coins and crypto, I find that like, that's a little annoying to me, but like, you know, the fact that it comes up, we could talk about stable coins all day. I think that they are one reason why I think it's possible the United States government even created Bitcoin was so that they could find a neutral, non-sovereign settlement layer and tether the dollar to some sort of heat sink and have the ability to sell treasuries, stablecoin companies. I think the stablecoins are a way, I think they further monetary colonialism for the United States government. But I think at the same time, they're a life raft to people who have every currency, every fiat currency that's worse than the dollar.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, those, you know, I don't think democracy is maybe the end, final, perfect government for humanity. But, you know, maybe the dollar will go into places where they have worse governments and it brings certain aspects of freedom and stability. But I think it'll also bring, you know, I think the dollar is a really double-edged sword. I think it's, you know, technological advancement over gold. It moves faster, different things like that. But I think, you know, credit creation and having a credit-backed system is probably a net negative for humanity in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So stablecoins are really interesting and tricky. I think also the history of stablecoins is very nefarious. And it's very interesting, the government rolling out the red carpet right now, not just sort of like tolerating Bitcoin and tolerating crypto, but really rolling out the red carpet for stable coins, I believe. I find it very disconcerting or frustrating that it seems like the sort of the most important work that seems to be happening in Bitcoin right now is to put dollars on Lightning or Liquid.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting. So like as a, you know, relatively financially privileged Westerner, it's my take just like from my vantage point is that stable coins are a CBDC that have yet to be activated. They're highly centralized. Tether already openly and admittedly censors transactions in compliance with law enforcement. And to me, that's like, that's a horrible gateway into a lot of really bad things.
Yes.
However, if I were in a very different position, I think what you're alluding to is if I'm in a place where my currency is collapsed and I have zero access to the US banking system and I can't afford a hardware wallet, much less to buy Bitcoin to secure my wealth. That suddenly Tether looks really attractive, right? And at least it's only losing 7% of value a year, with M2 growth versus 50% month over month. And so I sympathize that there are people who can utilize them today. However, when I speak about them, like on our show all the time, I'm speaking from my perspective as, you know, someone in the West. Stay the hell away from them. Like, in general, we don't need them. You know, like you can, if you need dollars, like you have access to the U.S. banking system. I think to the extent that you can opt out of that, the better. But I don't think stable coins are probably a solution that most people in the West need. And I think it's you're a hop, skip, and a jump from, you know, tyrannical overreach. And now I wanted to talk to you about digital IDs and CBDCs and all these things, but that's kind of my take on stable coins. I'm curious.
I agree 100% from both sides. As a Westerner, I don't think we really need them. But I think that we're going to be forced into them as much as you're involved in the United States banking system. I think your deposits will be stable coins in 2 to 4 years tops.
Yeah.
I think they're building out the rails now. They're building out the back end. I think right now there's a massive fight between the old banking system and the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and the new digital ecosystem that's being built out. I think Tether's been, I don't know if Tether's always been, Tether has a very opaque background. Brock Pierce is part of the founding. He's one of the founders of Tether, and Tether is now domiciled in El Salvador. El Salvador is a very, in my opinion, strange situation where, they're able to kind of buy Bitcoin and take on organizations like the IMF and live. And you would think at that point they would be our most hated enemy. But Tether, who we seem to be really cozying up to, is domiciled there, and we send them our criminals.
It's an odd situation.
Yeah, I happen to think they're like Malay and Bukele. I think it's a non-zero chance they're like CIA projects and outposts, and that they really want to, not just bring like sort of technology and manufacturing back to the United States of America, but to the Americas. And I think that I was talking about Paul Tarantino, my co-host on Bitcoin Center. And, you know, he was alluding to that we want to probably bring manufacturing there. We definitely want to dollarize all those countries. So we're sort of pivoting towards Latin America, and you can kind of see that with stable coins and sort of, I think, Tether and what's going to happen. And you could see, so over the last like 4 years, Latin America has used about $1.5 trillion in crypto transactions, and about 80 to 90% of that is stable coins. Like 315 billion of that is in Brazil, and only like $3.5 billion in El Salvador, and then every country in between, sort of. So, those economies are really turning. And remember, with stable coins, the United States government gets to really sell $2. Because you're selling the stable coin and the dollar treasury behind it. So it's a 2-for-1 deal for the U.S. government. And it allows them to do so much more with the treasury in terms of sort of like monetary printing or debt issuance, and not go through the Fed as much and use those tools. So I don't know. I think that the connection between digital ID and stable coins is everything. Like, this is the end game for humanity. Once those two things are, and I think we're kind of there. You were saying, Tether is already surveilled. I think of every dollar already as digital, and every dollar is, or we already have a social credit score in this country. It's your credit score, right? I mean, we already have a credit score that affects your mortgages and your ability to borrow credit and at what rate and if you've been good or bad. And a lot of times the more, what you would think is like closing credit lines and paying off credit lowers your credit score. I mean, it's a strange system with weird incentives there. But you connect sort of credit scores and digital dollars, and sort of central bank issuance of the, that's the CBDC. And
do you think that then, so you think we're getting pretty close to where, you know, anyone operating on dollars is effectively going to be using some sort of stable coin?
Yeah.
100%. So does that mean that is the is the way of defeating the what I perceive to be slavery that emerges from that, to build these circular economies where you're spending Bitcoin, you're onboarding local merchants, vendors here over the next, you know, 24 to 36 months to make sure that you've got that infrastructure. So when the option becomes Bitcoin or our stablecoin that is very easy to censor, that you have optionality.
Right. So, I see like we have sort of three ways we could go, you know, sort of the bright orange future just comes more or less immediately or smoothly. Then you have sort of we enter this draconian totalitarian CBDC phase. And the second and third path is either we come out of that or we don't. Mm. You know, and I'm, you know, I feel like with you know, someone like David Collum, he has a theory or thesis that, you know, there's just so much noise that no one could ever find this real signal anymore. Look at something like Charlie Kirk's assassination. Like, you just cannot, can you find truth there?
That's a good point.
You know, and I think that's by design. And can humanity come out of sort of, can we ever find our way out of this noise? Because that is a real, like, whoever controls all that noise, all that propaganda, those pipes, whoever controls the internet, it's like controlling the food supply. Yeah. And so, you know, are we, and so he's kind of the notion, it seems like we've passed the point of no return.
Hmm. So right? He's blackpilled.
He's blackpilled. And I mean, I was at dinner with Tom Luongo and he really got fucked. He was like, you need to see a fucking therapist.
Tom's funny, man.
But, you know, Tom thinks Trump is here to save the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they're all bullshit artists. I think he lives at the intersection of Bullshit Avenue and Bullshit Boulevard. Mm-hmm. You know, RFK Jr., I mean, you could put your tinfoil hat about the Kennedy family.
Yeah.
And even RFK Jr., I mean, he'll tell you he's got a lot of skeletons in his closet. His sort of campaign spiel was, everyone knows about my skeletons, so nobody could, you know, kind of corrupt me.
On him, yeah.
That's like a weird thing to say, but, you know, he's had a wife die on him, and his cousin, when they were very young, was accused of murder, like a friend, and that went on for like 25 years, that case, and the whole time RFK really swore by his cousin, his cousin's character, and all these things, and sort of after like 20 or 25 years, finally admitted, yeah, I did kill her. I mean, you have just a lot of murder and mystery in that family, and I just feel like it's the uniparty. I even think, like, with Bitcoin, one of the most disappointing things of the year 2025 was I felt that a lot the when Trump came to speak at the Bitcoin conference, that was like a Trump rally. And it was like, we love you, Trump. Like, you know, here's our three demands and you're our guy. Versus, like, come tell us what you'll do for us. Why don't we have everyone come and proffer what they'll do for us? We're the Orange Party. We are here for whoever, you know, whoever supports us the most. Not so much like, I feel like it was like almost like we become the Republican Party. And I think that's going to have, that can have negative reverberations. Again, I'm not talking about you or me as Bitcoiners or individuals, or I'm not saying you voted or I voted. But I'm saying, like, it felt like we bent the knee to Trump in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I agree. So I'll tell you my story.
And I don't think we got a lot for it, except for Ross. And that could be another conversation about tinfoil hat. But
I need to hear that in a minute. So a year and a half ago, I was in Nashville when Trump spoke. Really agree. I was kind of surprised that it felt like a Trump rally, and he could have almost said anything. If he just said Bitcoin, people would have.
I'm sorry to cut you. They fucked with us so hard, though, over the whole someone has breached the perimeter. Like, first of all, we had to wait an hour for them to tell us that someone breached security.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after Baxter or Butler, whatever it was called.
Butler, yeah, Butler, Pennsylvania. Butler. Yeah.
This was like a month after Butler. And he, like, so his team has already like failed him tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a room that's like a bandbox. And you had to wait like hours to get in. I mean, this was like, this was a humiliation ritual. Like, we had to wait hours to get in, and you couldn't brew. There was no food or drink allowed inside. And it was, like, impossible to get to a bathroom. So it was like a pen. And everyone was just penned up. And then he came, it was, like, on an hour late, they came over, and they're like, someone has breached security. And can you please self-report yourself? I mean, this is, like, we know someone breached security, but we don't know where they are.
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh, we now know it's Jordy. And Jordy, can you turn yourself in? I forget his last name. And I mean, he turns out, I think he's a Lightning developer. I mean, what, he hop a turnstile? And they were just like, stop that, man. And then they lost. I mean, what happened here?
Yeah.
And then like he comes out after about a 90 minute or 120 minute wait post when he was supposed to come out on a very tight schedule. And then he kind of laughs it off. Like, oh, they said, the Secret Service said someone broke the perimeter. So I said to them, take your time, as long as you need. Like, you now trust this team? I mean, the whole thing was absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt like, and this was, think about it. Like, you have supposedly, like, hardcore gun rights activists in this room. So they're all unarmed. You basically told them, there's a security threat. And then he comes out willy-nilly, like, an hour and a half later, 2 hours later, like, no big deal. It doesn't, like, really, like, they would have canceled the event if it was a real threat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how did they allow a threat like that to happen 4 weeks after? Like, does anyone have their stuff in order? So it's, like, not making me feel good about anything. And then, to your point, it was, like, a Trump rally. It was pro-Trump to the point where it didn't feel like a Bitcoin rally, and you're here to talk to us. It felt like we invited you because we love you.
Yeah. 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 I think that's right. Hey, before I forget, though, I want to, the Ross thing. Is there a conspiracy around Ross and the pardon?
I mean, I think it's a very weak conspiracy, but I felt like, you know, he comes out at the conference and, he's wearing a red tie. Like he's thanking Trump, as it seemed like the focus was most on thanking Trump, the Republican Party. And even the story he told about unity seemed very off to me. So, one, the thanking Trump thing is a very weird thing for me because Trump was his warden for 4 years. Like, from 2016 to 2020, that's the man who didn't let you out of jail. And that's the man who told the world Bitcoin was terrible and all these things. And then, in Nashville, tried to take credit for Bitcoin's price appreciation during his first term.
Yeah.
While he's shitting on it. Okay. And then, so I don't know if I'm going to thank my jailer when I get out. And if I'm this monetary revolutionary, like, the reason I bring up the story that he's told that day, like, I imagine the person who creates Silk Road is like really understands Bitcoin at a very deep level. Like, not price, not number go up, but like, this is monetary freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people can buy what they want with this. And it's not about anonymity. It's not the government won't know. It's the government can't stop it. Right? It's not like, oh, the government can't trace it. It's the Visa can't send the money back when they find out. So first, you come out wearing the red tie. How about no suit? Like, I got out of jail. Like, first of all, he got out of jail. He looked healthier than any 35-year-old I've ever seen in my life. And even go back to that original phone call that they played in Miami, I think it was, or a couple years before that. From, I mean, like, to me, that when I look back on it, very Blair Witchy. Like, how did you get the, how did you mic up the payphone? You know, like, why am I hearing every, like, it seemed a little staged going back on it. But he comes out, he's got the red tie on, he's all suited up. He's out there, he's like, hey, bro. He's like, he had the most stage composure I've ever seen. But then the story didn't jive in two ways. And I'm making a lot out, I'm making a mountain out of molehill. Don't get me wrong. But I'm just watching this, you know, I'm just really digging in. Because I think if there was ever a one, like one reason to vote for any president, it was to free Ross. Mm-hmm. That's how much Ross, the meaning of Ross means to me. Because I really see him as a political prisoner.
Yep.
And I think if you take on the endeavor Ross took on back in whenever he started Silk Road, like, you'd have to know that you're potentially going to be wanted. And I think, and you have to think about it. This is one of the reasons I question really if Satoshi was a government. I'm like, Ross knew that they were going to come. Like, he did everything he could to not be found. And he was somewhat, it was found. I mean, there's someone they found. They found Ross and went to jail. I don't think Ross did everything they accused him of. I mean, FBI agents went to jail. I think other people were Dred Roberts, all these things. But he tells the story. He's like, I'm going to start Silk Road. I don't want to start it with no inventory, though. So I'm going to start it with some mushrooms. And I don't want to buy drugs. So I'm going to grow my own mushrooms. And I'm going to rent this cabin far away. And I run into this hornet's nest, like all these hornet nests. I don't know if you remember this story. Wasp nest, not hornet's nest. Similar. That's why I thought it was interesting. Because we're the hornets, right? We're the cyber hornets. And here's where he's telling the story. We got to kill all the wasps. And I'm like, why you got to kill, you know, kind of similar here. And one of the reasons wasps are so good, you know, in his story, that they're so bad. They're one of their worst features is they're decentralized. But if you think about it. But he's like, these wasps are here, and I don't want to call my mom or dad because I don't want them to know I'm growing drugs. And he's like, you're about to start the Silk Road. Like, you're like about to go like dark, and you're worried about your landlord and like, where are you growing the mushrooms that you're like, do you just have like bags on the porch right now? Like, mushroom grower, you know, like, isn't, might not keep the stuff in the car when they, like, it was just a weird story. Like, but to me, to like that he was fearing, like the one, he was going to grow drugs for his web, the Silk Road. Like, he was going to, like, I don't know, like that it was going to be him as the number one farm on the Silk Road. Like, it didn't make sense that he had to seed it with, what, nine ounces of mushrooms, right? Or why not, like, just go driving in Oklahoma and find the mushrooms where they're just naturally evolving in Mill Knight? Whatever it is, it just didn't make sense to me. Then he's afraid of his mom, his dad, his landlord. So he's got to deal with this himself. And then I didn't like the whole story about killing the wasps because I just kept thinking about cyber hornets. And he basically defeats the wasps because they're like, and then I'm like, I don't know. The suit thing made me feel like, is he going to run for senator now? Is he going to want to be senator of Arizona for the Republican Party? Like, I don't know. And then,
everything you said, I've never thought about, so I can't weigh in with
it. His mom is gone, right? Like, his mom hasn't said a word. And then he's married. He came out, he was married. Like, who the fuck is this guy? I didn't know he was married. His mom never mentioned it. He never mentioned it. Not on the phone. Hey, guys, while I'm in here and I'm, like, we heard that, like, he went into, like, the hall because he took that phone call to be with us. Us. Not Trump. Right? Like, that was all about, like, supposedly he went in the hall with us. If you're going to do that for us, hey, guys, I got this pen pal girlfriend. She might be my wife one day. It's not all bad. He told us about the little tree. He had time to tell us about everything but the girlfriend and the wife. Or if I'm assuming there was an arc, you know. But, like, that was all left out. And he shows up. He looked so good when he came out of prison. and new girlfriend. And now I have heard from, let's call it secondhand people, like people who know people. So it means nothing. But that, like, he doesn't, you know, his mom is cut out a little bit and his wife seems like a handler. I don't know. It's just, you know, but at the same time, look, like, Ross to me was obviously a political prisoner. I think he was persecuted. They made that clear at the trial. Well, how the trial was handled, how the judges were picked in Schumer's district in New York. And this wasn't in San Francisco. This wasn't in Texas or Arizona, where he's from. None of that made sense. The things said at the trial, the fact that the FBI, two FBI people went to jail after the fact and their trials were kind of held back and not, that wasn't admitted evidence in Ross's trial. So many other people had access to the handle, all these things. He's, everything I've heard about, what I think is, I think his mom, everything she said is genuine and real. And she was talking about what a good kid he was. And I think the idea of Silk Road is really, I don't want to use words like brilliant or important. It's like, I think it's really like, it's a humanitarian thing, right? Like that was like, I remember like on my journey, listening to Peter McCormack being like, I don't smoke pot, but my mom was dying from cancer and I'm in England and I can't get pot here. And I can go on the Silk Road and buy my mom weed. And that's what I want to do for my mom with my money. Right. And then you could even read about drug activists, like drug activists. And they'll say like, I'm not pro drug use, but I think Silk Road is great for drug users because maybe they don't have to go into an alleyway and get robbed on the way in or the way out by the, even maybe the drug dealer. Right. And there are these, reviews and you get better quality and it's safer. And all these things. And I give all that credit to the creator, the founder of Silk Road. And you think about Ross, like being as young as he was, how many dots to connect to create Silk Road, right? It's sort of like you're creating, like, you know, it's like creating an Amazon, right? Like you have to create the back end, the front end, you have to seed it, you have to market it. Did an amazing job. And so, yeah, so some of those data points that I saw in person just didn't add up for me. You know, it's like, it's kind of sometimes when I got, when you remember Trump in that room in Nashville, right? I mean, he was like a Catskills comedian. I mean, you know, he was working in the room. He was definitely reading like what jokes were landing, repeat that three times until it's not funny anymore. Like it wasn't about like his, you could see his calculations, but it made him, he seemed authentic in some ways. Like he can talk about certain topics, like, in certain, but I also feel like he's pandering to the room. Like he'll talk about vaccines in that room and childhood health and, you know, all cancer mortality, right?
Drill, baby, drill.
Things that work in that room that make sense. And you say, that makes sense to me. He'll go in a different room and say different things, though. And that's what's like, you know, so you know, like in 1999, Al Gore came and spoke at my college. And I skipped class and I went and saw him to speak. And one thing that was interesting to me was that he was funnier than the press gave him credit for. He was funnier in person than the press gave him credit for. And much more humble than the press gave him credit for. And at that point in my life, I was probably rooting for, I was definitely rooting for the Clinton administration. And or for maybe Bush to be reelected, I guess, at that point. Not Bush, Gore, to get not reelected. Gore to be elected in 2000, coming out of the Clinton regime, and but that the, so I still hate politicians. I still think it's a uniparty, but I did notice in my with my own eyes that that the press is not telling me the truth, right? Like so, and you can do that with anything. Like if my dad is a really good was a really good fisherman, he could read the press and the fishing story didn't make sense. He'd be like, "That was a shit article." He'd still read the paper like the rest was truth, right? But you can start like, hey, like you can start connecting those dots, right? Like it's a kind of a Bitcoin way of thinking about things. Like don't trust, verify, right? Like you start, you know, my people in my life, like they'll say, you, what news do you trust? I say, I don't trust any news. Well, what website do you go to? I don't trust the website. Well, what independent journalists do you trust? I don't trust any of them. I read some of them and I trust some more than others. I trust some on certain topics. But you get good at reading an article, like you have a headline, and just to say everything you read, just read critically. You read the headline and you start by paragraph three. You're like, they haven't supported this headline. You know, you can read something like Bitcoin's bad for the environment. It's like nine paragraphs in. It's like, and then it takes more energy than Denmark. And that's not as much energy as dryers. So maybe it's not a big deal. That's in paragraph nine. You know, my mom or someone in my family would send an article. They'll be like, aha. And then you're like, did you read the article? Yeah. Did you read it critically? Because if you read, you know, sometimes you're like, in the article, it refutes the article. If you actually read it, when they cop out in paragraph 10, right? Like paragraphs 2 through 7 are opinions. Jimmy on the corner thinks Bitcoin is really noisy and bad for the environment. And we talked to Susie in the laundromat about it. But here's the survey in paragraph 8 about how it's, you know, about the size of Denmark's power grid. And that's really not even as much as Netflix uses.
Right. I'll tell you something maybe you'll appreciate that I've been doing is I have a friend who's a he was a client of the Bitcoin Way. I've had him on the podcast a few times. And for a while, as I was trying to sort through, like, who do I trust? I'd be like, okay, so what do you think about some of these people who are now coming out and saying more controversial things, like the Candace Owens, the Tuckers? You know, they've like parted ways with like mainstream, you know, Republican thinking. And I'll sort of paraphrase his opinion is like, they're full of shit. And I was like, you know what? And so where I've come to is we have grown to look for the next best person all the time to tell us what to think instead of going to first principles. So like I've been listening to a podcast it's called Path to Liberty from the 10th Amendment Center. And this guy just like goes through the history of like what the founding fathers wrote about, personal letters, private letters, the Anti-Federalists, the Federalists, and sort of dissects the ways in which the Constitution, our country was founded, in what that means and how far we've come from that. And with that understanding, it's much easier for me to make determinations about, you know, all of the bad things that government's doing today from a first principles perspective, instead of, you know, what is my, you know, the guy who I voted for, what does he say about it? Doesn't matter. What is Candace Owens? What is Tuck? Doesn't matter. Like, you go back to like, what's the intent of this thing that exists? And I'm going to make decisions based upon that knowledge versus being spoon-fed something from any influencer, right, left, center, libertarian, it doesn't matter. I think learning about learning history, I think, is like the antidote to falling into a lot of these traps that we tend to. And that's a more recent journey for me. So I'm still I feel like I'm catching up on all this, but you're hitting on a lot of great points.
Even with history though, is that you got to fight to find source text.
Yeah. Correct. But when I like now I look at like, there are some very controversial documentaries on World War II that take the complete opposite stand of, you know, what you're taught in like mainstream, you know, elementary, middle school. I'll just look at both, right? Like I'm going to look at both. I'm going to look at things in between, you know, and you can like some of it doesn't, the truth doesn't fundamentally matter all of the time. Like what actually happened in World War II doesn't necessarily impact, you know, a decision I'm going to make tomorrow. But it helps me to think more critically about what is happening in the world around me, because for all of the people pushing this narrative, and then there's all the people pushing this narrative, there's probably elements of truth, or they couldn't just get away with, you know, a 100% lie. It's like 99% lie, but they put a little nugget in there just to, you know, to make you think twice about doubting them. But it's, I guess it's just like this, the lost art of critical thinking is kind of what I'm getting to, evaluating all the evidence at hand. You know, taking everything that someone says with a grain of salt and doing your own research to the best of your ability.
I wonder how much we're being fed certain narratives to make us regarded. I don't mean dumb us down, but to, you know, whether you could pick any sort of hot bun issue and there's going to be a certain segment of the pop, a large part of the population is going to be like, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you might be tracking like 10 conspiracies and four, like you might be dead on about 8 or 9 of them. But the one or two that are you're being fed like in a way that's probably nefarious, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
they want you second guessing yourself too. You know, like, yeah, it's and by they, I don't even know when I say they, I don't even know who I mean exactly.
I've been going through, you know, I try to avoid like pop culture now. Mm-hmm. Or, and not every single part of it, but I, you know, and I find a lot of it to be demonic and degrading. And I look back at a lot of things I partake in, like I'm a hip hop head, and you know, as my kids get older, I'm like, I can't play this around them. You know, it's just, it's not what I want them to be. It's like, it's not a good diet. And, but like my son, you know, he really wants, we're watching the Marvel universe. And we're going through like every single Marvel, you know, movie. And I've never interested in these things, but, you know, coming to it to watch through his eyes, like I see it's, I saw, I didn't like Hollywood going towards that, but you could see that's where they put all their production and effort, right? So you have good actors or notable actors, whether you think they're good or not, and lots of production value and some decent storylines. But there's so much like, you know, aliens, the other world, the ice walls, the sort of multiple timelines, multiverse. You have shapeshifters. You have in a 2014 movie of Iron Man 2, it's like you have the age of like the AI that sort of wants to take over the world, and they're all fighting, and he comes in robot form, you know. And so how much of this is seeding and priming, or is it just on honest creation, right? I mean, do they just happen to be thinking about these things, the artists? To me, it seems like seeding and priming, you know, and it seems ubiquitous, right? In sort of all culture and all sort of movies, music, at least to me, you know, you put on like anything from Disney and you got the monsters in the closet, the monsters under the bed, you know, you can take that stuff in very dark sort of tinfoil hat directions.
You know, the hard thing is when you become attuned to this stuff, you probably see it in places where it doesn't exist, because you become hypersensitized, because you know you've been lied to, you know it's been seeded in some places, right. And it becomes much harder to discern what's, you know, what's real and what's just your imagination running wild.
I mean, Tucker Carlson, you know, I've never been a fan. I try not to be a fan of any particular man's or woman's work. I like ideas, and I think ideas have people. But I think Tucker really is a great interviewer, and I think he gets amazing guests, and I think he asks great questions. So I don't love everything about his style. I don't enjoy necessarily like being with him the way I would some of my favorite podcasters, maybe. But he's got great guests, and you know he is also very, so his guests are great. He has very interesting sometimes takes. And he's a weird person to me because his father ran Voice of America. And I don't believe anything. I think he's a limited hangout. I think that's the new mainstream media. And they're moving it there, him and Rogan, to be like a CBS or an ABC or sort of the water cooler narrative or moment for society as much as they can, because it's very fragmented. But he thinks the internet is demonic. You know, and then you have sort of questions around like, you know, Peter Thiel and, you know, the Antichrist and, you know, AI. You know, I don't know. But at the same time, maybe these are just like simple LLM programs and they're not alive. And I don't know.
Yeah. Peter Thiel's not doing himself any favors. You saw that interview where they were asking him about, you know, being the Antichrist. He is a terrible interviewer, man.
Adam Jones was like defended Peter Thiel on Tucker Carlson. I'm not saying defended Peter Thiel, but he was like, we should be talking about the Antichrist.
Who did?
Alex Jones.
Okay.
So, I recently was listening to Dave Collins said, you got to listen to this Alex Jones, Tucker Carlson interview. And I'll tell you, it was actually riveting. I'm not an Alex Jones fan. But I found myself agreeing a lot what he was saying. Mm-hmm. And he seems very pragmatic. Like just politically, if we're going to talk, he's very like sort of pro Trump on some things. He's very upset about how he's handling some other things and like things like Iran and whatever. But we're just war and defense. So, you know, I thought it was an extremely balanced conversation. But at the same time, you know, they'll talk about things like, you know, maybe the internet's demonic. And I do worry about like AI, but sort of like kind of going off on its own. You know, supposedly like when they're training or teaching AI, they have to like train it to be helpful and not like having bad traits. Like, it's so interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wonder like how many of these are, and I don't believe when someone says like, we only train them to be nice. Like, I don't believe you. I just don't believe there's not going to be someone who comes along who's like, why don't we try something? So yeah, I mean, it seems like that. And at the same time, maybe that's just an empty threat from people like Sam Altman, who are just trying to, you know, sort of like the climate change and threat and sort of like how that's a huge grift. And so I think there's a grift aspect of this too. But you know, they just rolled out Project Genesis, which is, you know, trillions, I guess, invested in AI. And I thought that was a very interesting name because of Genesis Block.
Yeah. It's, I'm kind of the point where I try to go back to the smartest people talking about important things to where I can better think for myself. And like, I think like, you know, I've got young kids that were homeschooling. And so I have to think about like, how do I sift through this stuff to impart wisdom and knowledge both on the next generation. And I think it's going to be, you know, there are a few hills I would die on that I'll try to impart knowledge. But in general, my goal would be to impart wisdom, to be discerning.
So what do you think are the important things right now?
Well, I think, for me personally, I'm a Christian. I believe the evidence is suggestive that my faith is well-founded in facts. And that's certainly one thing. But I think as I get deeper into things practically, like Austrian economics, for example, I mean, I'll teach, you know, like, hey, this is what Keynesians think, yeah. This is what the monetarists, you know, it is, like, there are other sides of this coin, but here's where they fall down, you know, if you put any logic to it. And so like, I think a lot of these like principles, natural rights, like, right, you have, whether you think it's God-given or natural law is almost irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were born on a deserted island, like, you could say whatever you want, right? Okay, so why can't you say whatever you want in the UK? Well, because they're imposing the paper law and enforcement by violence onto your natural right. Like, that just makes sense. Like, there's a logic to that that I can articulate to my child as they reach an age to have that conversation. And so there are like these foundational principles of what it means to be human that I think I can more confidently say, this is real, this is the way it is. And then you take that understanding and then you begin to apply it to other aspects of, you know, the world around you. And you make your best call on what's right, try to understand who's telling the truth and who isn't based on, you know, some of these foundational principles. But for me, it becomes very easy to decide. Like, so the reason I used to rely on a political commentator to tell me what to think was because there was no foundation for what I thought, except I'm a Republican or whatever, right? Now, if I'm like, okay, I'm a natural rights guy, anything that infringes upon my natural right to self-protection, to free speech, so on and so forth, that's a violation. I don't need a commentator explaining to me if it's okay or it's good or, hey, they're well-intended. Doesn't matter. You infringe upon my natural rights, I'm not okay with it. And like, that becomes a much easier place from which to begin making decisions about what you agree with, what you disagree with, what you do. And I think those are like the foundational principles that I would, you know, want to impart with on my kids.
I think those are all fantastic. I agree 100%. I'm trying to build on those in a Bitcoin way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does Bitcoin fit into that, right? Because I think all that you said there precludes or sort of comes before Bitcoin, right? Morals, mm-hmm. Yeah. Ethical. And I think you say, oh, Bitcoin is moral money, right? It's ethical money. That's very important to me, right? And I think the only way to express that is through self-custody. And I don't think that's through an ETF, right? And I think if you're, you know, from your very first sat, you know in your future, and only if you have one, at some point you're going to be wealthy, right? And then 2140, there will only be one set every 10 minutes. So at some point, you will be incredibly wealthy on a Bitcoin standard. That's how my mind works when I start looking at things like sort of on the timeline or exponential. Like, buy $100 in Bitcoin one day, if that's all you can afford, you will be wealthy if you hold on to that. So just let's use the premise, because, you know, most of us aren't incredibly wealthy now, but one day Bitcoiners will be incredibly wealthy. Some already are, the OGs before us, whatever. But one day, you know, early adopters and late adopters and adopt will be wealthy, right? And they'll be the productive people, whatever, as well, to acquire the Bitcoin, right? And so maybe they don't acquire it at these cheap prices, but one day they will become wealthy from just their productive value that then they save. So I look at like Kurt Cobain, right? And someone like Kurt Cobain had like all this, like you could, I'm making an assertion, but let's say back in the 90s, people say, I'm not going to sell out. You know, Nirvana never sold out, man. You know, Fugazi never sold out. My favorite indie rock band never sold out, you know? And part of that was like, you know, you can do live shows, you sell your records. It's not that you're not making money. It's not that Kurt Cobain didn't have a nice house, but he's like, I'm not going to put my song in like a Toyota commercial. You know, like I don't want it to be played in the mall, in the elevator, right? I'll just try to eke out my wealth a different way. And then he dies, and we could talk, that's a whole rabbit hole, but like, but he dies, and you know, his wife eventually sells the whole musical catalog to a PE firm for $50 million.
Yeah. It's a misalignment of principles. It's
So the sovereignty and the self-custody is gone from the next generations. And he wasn't able to sort of pass on that value, right? And I worry about Bitcoiners, like, you know, you try to teach your kids, but some Bitcoiners are eventually going to pass on great wealth to the next generation or the one after. And at some point, a generation is going to receive the wealth. And that very wealth, right, that very self, the very having the asset, but not in their mind, maybe they only think of the number. And you see this a lot. It's very hard to keep any sort of business in the family for three generations, right? The first generation works their butt off for it. The second generation sees that. The third generation is like, I want to go skiing in Vail. You know, like I want to sell all that to buy the yacht, the plane, and enjoy it. I don't remember anyone working that hard for it. Why are we not? You know what I mean? And you lose at some point that steward of the, not just the asset, but the ethos. Right, because the Cobains, they still had the money. They didn't have the asset anymore. In fact, maybe they had more money now, right? Like, Courtney's like, hey, I got this catalog of music. It brings in 200 grand a year. I could get 50 grand tomorrow, 50 million tomorrow.
Yeah, they killed the golden goose. Yeah.
They killed the golden goose, right? But part of that golden goose in Bitcoin is the actual, you can still have number go up in the ETF. So maybe the government says, hey, look, like we notice your second generation Bitcoin, your third generation Bitcoin, you know, that's nuclear grade monetary technology. Like you really shouldn't hold that yourself. North Korea might try to hack you, right? Like, well, we had that strategy hack 5 years ago. You know, self-custody is not good for the country. If it's in the ETF, whatever you sell is tax exempt. But if you sell your real Bitcoin, 90% taxes on the capital gains, right? And you could see a world where people are like, because what you were talking about with circular economies, if it's not a favorable environment, that's going to take action in the physical world, not just in cyberspace, just saving digitally in cyber. You have this immutable savings in cyberspace. You know, you got your energy, your fire, just no leakage, but you, how do you use it in the real world if the government wants to tax it 90% or your neighbors think you're a bad person because you have it in self-custody, right?
Yeah, you raise a lot of interesting points. And I mean, in terms of how I think about raising the next generation is to become so fiercely disciplined, self-sufficient, competent, and sovereign-minded so as to be able to disregard, you know, like when, like my dad taught me a lot of things. I had a great dad, but I went through the public school system, very traditional, you know, sort of academic path. He would teach me things. I never like intellectually sparred with my father. And I want to have like those Socratic dialogues, you know, with my son. And Lord knows I won't do it justice, but for him to feel like we can bounce these ideas in the early, like the younger he is, the easier it's going to be for me to, you know, beat up on him. And right. then he gets older, if he can continue to withstand that. And at the same time, I'm growing, I'm helping to foster competence in a number of areas to keep him focused and oriented against someone else is going to give me a handout. Someone else is going to provide for me. You've got to work. You've got to pay your way. There's all you always have a safety. I'm never going to let my kids starve, right? Like, I don't think any parent would. Like, you can understand that you're going to go through life with that. But unless you need a true safety net, like I'm not paying your bills. I'm not, you know, doing these things for you. You're going to raise a pretty fiercely independent kid, especially with us homeschooling. He has none of the influence of, you know, mainstream mm-hmm. academia. I won't pay for him to go to college if it looks anything like it does currently. And, you know, I'm confident that in spite of all of my personal flaws and shortcomings as a man, I can raise him to be, you know, much further along than I was at age 18. And then when he goes out into the world, he's going to be better. And then he's going to have this discipline, this competence instilled in him that he can raise, you know, the generation after that. So you can't ensure that your bloodline stays self-sovereign forever, but you can do what you can do in the short term to make it most likely.
Yeah, I agree. It's so I think the number one reason I do my podcast is it's sort of a time capsule, I think, for my kids. And I'm hopeful that they'll hear at least my questions. I'm kind of pretty confident they won't get any real good answers from the show, but like they'll get good questions, I hope.
Curiosity. You
know? Yeah, curiosity. And I really want them to sort of not defy authority, but to question authority, to like be little terrorists. You know, I love like, you know, sort of fight for themselves, think for themselves. So, you know, but at some point, you know, they are who they are. And I'm saying that in general about, you know, everyone's kids, you know, like I think that you go through like almost like phases in life. Like, I mean, I did spar with my dad a lot in a good way, like healthy Socratic debates. I felt like I always felt like he was wrong. And
until you got
what?
Until you got older.
Until I got older. You know. And then I don't think he was necessarily it's not that I think he was like more right than I realized, but I realized I didn't know, you know, there was more I didn't know that I didn't know I knew.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like immense. It's like I think I would like concede, like I don't know. But like I had no idea how much I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's well said, man. Cedric, I think we kind of covered the topics I wanted to cover today. So we can head for home. That was a fun 20-30 minutes of just chatting. I got to ask you though. I hope you got one in the back of your mind. What is an unpopular opinion you have, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
All right, I guess the most unpopular opinion. I'm pro knots. It's not, I'm not pro knots. I'm pro decentralization of the reference client. And I'm kind of anti-core right now. I'm not anti-everything core is done. I'm not anti-individuals in core per se at just a broad strokes. I don't like the whole model. I think it's broken. I think it's, I don't necessarily think that this issue is the most serious concern, but I think the fact that we are just like, we look like dipshits during this whole thing, and the way is a serious concern, because when a big issue that's important comes up, I don't have a lot of faith that we will be able to reach sort of some pragmatic real healthy consensus.
Yeah.
I do think certain things about what this particular issue has been handled by Core have been terrible. I think we could have had easily a compromise at raising up return 2 or 3x and say, what is an incremental change, you know, sort of bring on the whole network. For me, it's been eye-opening because I just don't understand well enough the interplay between policy and consensus rules.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it reminds me a lot of 2017 when I first came in and there was the block size wars. And, you know, it does not seem like a mature asset that you'd want to put your life savings into. I'm not talking about me where I am, but I would see like for outsiders. Like I was trying to describe this to my brother and I felt like this was just like embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, trying to explain this to him. And I you know, if you think about like the amount of code, 700,000 lines of code, I don't think there's a human on earth that should be able to alter this code unilaterally, meaning like write code and upload it to the system. Even if it's been reviewed, I don't think there'd be a human on earth who could review it in a complete way and say, I understand all the second and third order effects of this change on all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm not necessarily for ossification. And I think that's also, I think this is like where it's like a two-sided attack where it's like, that's like damned if we do, damned if we don't, because it's like we're one way, everyone's like, well, now we're censoring ourselves. And if we move the other way, we're like letting people take a shit in the public pool. And we're saying, oh, there's no rules here. So that's allowed and you can ruin the pool for everyone.
Yeah, I agree with you. So the way I run Knots, I originally fell into the same tribalistic trap that I have historically done. I was like, hey, I'm team Knots, like Bitcoin's money, obviously still feel that way. I think as I've dug in a little bit into the technical debate, I think you can make a case for both sides. What I'm completely uncomfortable with, as what I think you've described well, is I think that if you are going, it's going to be messy. It's a decentralized open source monetary protocol. So I'm under no illusion it's going to be the same thing as Twitter deciding to change the user interface, you know, on your feed or something. It's going to be a lot messier. But for the core devs to face what I perceive to be very legitimate and real disagreement in the public sphere, and that's, and you know, they can say X, you know, doesn't count. There's a lot of Bitcoiners on X, and there are a lot of people who aren't on X who don't know that they could have an opinion on this. And if they heard Mechanic or Luke talk, they might well agree with them. And then some of them might agree with the core devs. This was a very contentious debate to then push through, in my view. And if they can do that, and I agree with you, I don't know that this isn't the thing that kills Bitcoin, but what is core version 31, 32, 35, 40 going to look like? What can they push through then moving forward? Because now they feel like they've got permission to push whatever they want through. And if they want to try making it look more like Ethereum, it's not clear to me what's stopping them, you know? And so I agree with you. We need more implementations.
I think we need less development on Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we don't need bells and whistles. We need to work on privacy, security, self-custody, UI. I'm appalled at the notion that people have a job as called Bitcoin Core developer. No one should be able to hire someone and say that person is a Bitcoin Core developer. I hired them.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's obviously not a company. But then you look at it from the notion of if a monopoly lost 20% of their business share, their market share, in a matter of weeks or months, like heads would roll.
Right.
Like at Bud Light, when they have horrendous campaigns and they lose serious market share on thin margins. So just sort of how contentious it was, how they kind of, you know, closed debate on the GitHub forum, these different things, I think was terrible. But I don't like the money in Bitcoin. I don't like the fiat in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I'm very concerned about someone hiring people to work on Bitcoin. I think it should be more of a voluntary type thing where people work on Bitcoin and they're like, I have the thing now, or do you like my idea? Should I go work on the thing? And if you want to hire people to work on the thing, that doesn't mean they are on the thing. They're your hires. You know, it's a very strange, archaic process. And, you know, maybe it's something where, like, we're going to have AI write the code for us, right? And have AI review that for us. And then have humans review that.
Who's going to develop the LLMs, though?
Well, here we go, right? We reach consensus. Yeah. So,
yeah, man.
This is where we're going to have to grow up and figure something out. Mm-hmm. And what we witnessed was not, you know, sort of the path there. I hope people are meeting offline and you know, maybe reaching a greater form of consensus, not on Twitter. So that's admittedly, it's not all of Bitcoin. And there is no Bitcoin because it's not, you know, human. There's no real community. And it's not a great place to have any sort of conversation or debate.
Yeah. My opinion at the moment, very much open to being amended, is...
Yeah,
we need to get a solution for quantum computing. I don't think it's like tomorrow that's an issue, but I think that's like an obvious thing that if it became an issue, it does become an existential threat. We fix that. We basically more or less ossify periodic updates, you know, routine kind of stuff the way you do with most applications. And if someone has something that they want to contribute, they've got to fight for it hard and convince everyone else this is for the best. And if not, they just don't achieve consensus. That fails. And we just continue it. We operate on a Bitcoin standard, the Bitcoin way. It works as money. We can we operate largely on chain. Obviously Lightning makes certain things easier, but I get paid in Bitcoin. We only accept Bitcoin as payment. We work with like maybe Riverside, who we record the podcast on, one or two vendors who don't accept Bitcoin. And so it works. And until it doesn't work, I don't see a whole lot of room for justifying big changes. So that's my take. I think that's a good unpopular, but you'll piss some people off, but it didn't piss me off.
Well, Bitcoin is money. It's just not accepted everywhere.
That's right. That's right. Well, Cedric, hey, thank you so much for your time, man. This has been a blast. Why don't you tell people where they can find you? Tell about your awesome podcast. It's one of my favorites.
Well, check out the Bitcoin Matrix. You can find us on X at _BitcoinMatrix. My handle is Ced Youngelman, CedYoungelman. And you can find us anywhere you download or view podcasts on YouTube, on Rumble. And we have a new show, Bitcoin Center, live Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern. My co-host, Paul Tarantino. We just sort of like Pardon the Interruption. So we just have a bunch of topics. We debate, lots of laughs, jokes, and debate, and a little bit about Bitcoin. So. Yeah, check it out. Come check out the show. We do philosophical conversations on the societal, cultural, and economic impacts of Bitcoin on humanity.
Terrific. Cedric, thanks so much for the time, man. Look forward to catching up soon.
Oh, thanks so much. This has been a blast.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Cedric. I know I sure did. Go check out his podcast. Go follow him on X. He's putting out some incredible content. And like I said, super based guy with a lot of fantastic takes on many of the important topics of the day. We love his focus on self-custody, self-sovereignty. So of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go over to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We got a Plan B residency option. We can even help you set up your BitAx, do some solo mining, play the lottery every 10 minutes. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Do me a favor, if you're enjoying the channel, if you like the show, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share this with someone who you think might enjoy it as well. Anything to feed the algorithm to get the signal out into the world would be most appreciated. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.